moves a bottle of wild turkey.
A little pick-me-up, she says, climbing back into bed. I think we need it. The wild turkey is passed back and forth, both of us swigging directly from the bottle. Each swallow is a burning lump sliding down my throat. They ignite faint traces of memory. Me and Janelle on the first night in our dorm room. The two of us shoulder to shoulder. Her drinking wine coolers she had flirted from a junior across the hall. Me sipping a Diet Coke. We became best friends that night. I still think of her as that. My best friend. It doesn't matter that she's 10 years in the grave and that I know our friendship wouldn't have survived even if she had. This is just for tonight, you know, Sam says. I'll be gone in the morning. You can stay as long as you need. And I only need one night. You should have told me you were struggling, I say. I'm happy to help. I can loan you money, or whatever. I'm sure that'll go over real well with your boyfriend. I take a swig of wild turkey and cough. Don't worry about Jeff. He doesn't like me. He doesn't know you yet, Sam. I pause. Or should I call you Tina? Sam, she says. The Tina thing is just a formality. How long has it been since you did that? Sam takes a drink, talking while swallowing. Years. When you disappeared? Yeah. I was sick of being Samantha Boyd, the final girl. I wanted to be someone else. At least on paper.
Does your family know?
Sam shakes her head and passes me the bottle before scooting off the bed. Her first destination is her knapsack, out of which is pulled a pack of cigarettes. Then it's on to the window where she says, Can I? I shrug my permission and Sam opens the window. Outside, thin clouds streak the bruised black sky. The darkness hums with faint energy. Dawn is approaching. I need to quit, Sam says as she lights up. Smoking's gotten too damn expensive. Not to mention deadly, I say. She blows a stream of smoke through the window screen. That part doesn't worry me. I've already cheated death once, right?
So you started after the nightlight in?
I needed something to calm me down, you know?
Oh, yes, I know.
Besides the Xanax, my go-to relief valve is wine. Red, white, or in between, it doesn't matter. I'm certain Janelle would have found that ironic. I'm surprised you and Lisa never started, Sam says. It seems so natural to me.
I tried it once. Didn't like it.
A question pings into my head.
How do you know Lisa didn't smoke?
I assume she didn't, Sam says. She didn't mention it in her book or anything. The first half inch of her cigarette has become a cylinder of ash, on the verge of dropping to the floor. She steps away from the window, the hand holding the cigarette remaining by the screen, while her free arm reaches for the knapsack and pulls out a portable ashtray. Leather and bag-like, it looks like a coin purse with a snap clasp. Displaying the dexterity of a longtime smoker, Sam flicks it open and, with a tap, deposits the ash dangling from the cigarette.
So you did read her book? I say.
Sam inhales, nods, exhales. I thought it was okay. It sure as hell didn't help me deal with what happened to me.
Do you think about it a lot?
I take another swallow of wild turkey, getting used to its warmth in the back of my throat. Sam reaches out an arm, seeking the bottle. When I hand it to her, she takes two hard swallows, only a puff of her cigarette separating them. Constantly. She passes the bottle back to me. I raise it to my lips, my quiet words reverberating against the glass. Do you want to talk about it? Sam finishes her cigarette with a single grand exhalation. It's then tapped out in the ashtray, which she promptly shuts. When the window is closed, smoke continues to sting the air of the room, lingering like a bad memory. "You think it only happens in the movies," she says. "That it couldn't happen in real life. At least, not like that. And certainly not to you. But it happened. First at a sorority house in Indiana, then at a motel in Florida." She slides off her jacket, revealing more of the black dress underneath. Her arms and shoulders are exposed, the flesh tight and moon pale. On her back, a tattoo of the Grim Reaper has been inked just below her right shoulder, its skeletal face momentarily bisected by the strap of her dress. "Calvin Whitmer," she says, climbing back into bed. "The Sack Man." The name prompts a deep internal shiver. It feels like a chunk of ice is tangled among my organs. "You said his name." "Why wouldn't I?" "I've never said his name." There's no need for me to clarify. She knows who I'm talking about. "Not once." "It doesn't bother me," Sam says as she pulls the bottle from my grip. "I think about him all the time. I can still see him, you know, when I close my eyes." He had cut eye holes into the sack, plus a little slit right over his nose for air. I'll never forget the way it flapped when he breathed. He had tied string around his neck to keep the sack in place. I sense another chunk of ice forming in my gut. I take the wild turkey from Sam, even though she's not finished with it. I swallow two gulps, hoping it will melt the chill. "Too many details?" Sam says. I shake my head. "Details matter." "What about you? Do you remember any details at all?"
"A few."
"But not much?"
"No."
"I've heard it's not a real thing," she says. "All that repressed memory stuff." I help myself to another swallow, trying to ignore the vague needling from Sam. Despite all we have in common, she's incapable of peering into my brain and seeing the black hole where memories of Pine Cottage should be. She'll never know how comforting yet frustrating it is to remember the very beginning of something and then the tail end. It's like leaving a theater 5 minutes into the movie and returning right when the end credits start to roll. "Trust me," I say. "It's real."
"And you don't mind not remembering?"
"I think it's probably better that I don't."
"But don't you want to know what really happened?"
"I know the end result," I say. "That's all I need to know."
"I heard it's still standing," Sam says. "Pine Cottage. I read it on one of those shitty true crime sites."
I had read the same thing several years ago. Probably on the same website. Once the investigation was over, Pine Cottage's owner had tried to sell the land. No one wanted it, of course. Nothing sinks land values more than blood in the soil. When he went into bankruptcy, it passed into the hands of his creditors. They couldn't sell it either. So Pine Cottage remains, a cabin-sized tombstone in the Pennsylvania woods.
"You ever think about going back there and taking a look?" Sam asks. "Maybe it would help you remember."
The very idea nauseates me.
"Never."
"Do you ever think about him?"
It's obvious she wants me to say his name. Anticipation pulses like body heat off her skin.
"No,"
I lie.
"I figured you'd say that," Sam says.
"It's true." I have another swallow of wild turkey and stare into the bottle, taken aback by how much we've had. Actually, by how much I've had. Sam, I realize, has barely touched it.
I close my eyes, swaying a little. I can feel myself teetering on the edge of being drunk. One more drink will do the trick. I tip the bottle back, take two gulps, relish their burn. Sam's voice has become distant and tinny, even though she's right beside me. You act like you're totally over what happened, but you're not. You're wrong, I say. Then prove it. Tell me his name. We should try to sleep, I say, looking to the window in the increasingly lightened sky. It's late. Or early. There's no reason to be afraid, Sam says. I'm not. It's not like it'll bring him back to life. I know. Then why are you being such a pussy about it? She sounds exactly like Janelle. Nudging, prodding, goading me into something I don't want to do. Annoyance swells inside me, tinged with anger. When I try to tamp it down with more wild turkey, I realize Sam's taken the bottle from my hands. You are, you know, she says, being a pussy. That's enough, Sam. If you're so over everything that happened, then a simple name shouldn't be that big of a deal. I'm going to bed. Sam grabs my arm when I try to leave. I jerk free of her grip, slide off the bed, and hit the floor, hard. Pain spreads up my hip. Drunk on both wild turkey and lack of sleep, it takes some effort to stand. The whiskey sloshes sourly in my stomach. My vision swims. Sam makes things worse by saying, I wish you'd say it. No. Just once. For me? I turn on her, wildly unsteady. Why are you making such a big deal out of this? Why are you so against it? Because he doesn't deserve to have his name spoken, I yell, my voice loud in the pre-dawn silence. After what he did, no one should say his fucking name. Sam's eyes go wide. She knows she's pushed me too far. You don't need to freak out about it. Apparently I do, I say. I'm doing you a favor by letting you crash here. You are. Don't think I don't know that. And if we're going to be friends, you need to also know that I don't talk about Pine Cottage. I've moved past it. Sam looks down, both hands on the bottle, cradling it between her breasts. I'm sorry, she says. I didn't mean to be such a bitch. A moment of sobriety arrives as I stand in the doorway, hand on my throbbing hip, trying my damnedest not to look as drunk as I truly am. Maybe you're right. Maybe it is best if you leave in the morning. Having spoken coherently, drunkenness again crashes over me. I sway out of the room, needing multiple attempts to close the door behind me. Then it's into my own room, where more wrangling with a door ensues. Jeff is half awake when I flop into bed, murmuring, I heard shouting.
It's nothing.
You sure?
Yes,
I reply, too exhausted to say more. Before I free fall completely into sleep, a thought cuts through the fuzz of my brain. It's a flash of memory, an unwelcome one. Kim, during the moment we first met. Before the killing started. Before he became him. A second thought arrives, one more troublesome than the first. Sam wanted me to remember. What I don't understand is why.
Pine Cottage, 5:03 p.m. Janelle decided she wanted to explore the woods, knowing full well the group agreed ahead of time to do the birthday girl's bidding. So off they went, tramping into the trees that practically nudged up against the cabin's back deck. Craig, the former Boy Scout, led the way with a determination that was almost silly. He was the only one who brought along proper footwear, hiking boots with heavy-duty socks pulled over his taut calves to guard against ticks. He carried an absurdly long walking stick, which struck the ground in a rhythmic thud. Quincy and Janelle were right behind him, less serious. Wearing jeans, striped sweaters, and impractical keds, they kicked their way through the fallen leaves that coated the forest floor. More leaves continued to fall, the late afternoon sunlight shining through their brittle thinness as they spun, tumbled, and whirled. Falling stars speckled red and orange and yellow. Janelle grabbed a leaf in mid-fall and tucked it behind her ear, its fiery orange glowing against her auburn hair. "I demand a picture," she said. Quincy obliged, snapping off two shots before turning around and taking one of Bette's, trudging heavily like she'd done all day. To her, this trip was more burden than gift, a weekend to be endured. "Smile," Quincy ordered. Bette's frowned. "I'll smile when this hike is over." Quincy took her picture anyway, before moving on to Amy and Rodney, walking as one, their hips all but connected. Since they were never not together, everyone else had taken to calling them Ramdy. Amy wore one of Rodney's flannel shirts, the two long sleeves hanging past her fingertips. Beside her, Rodney resembled a grizzly bear, with his stoner scruff and thatch of chest hair peeking over the collar of his V-neck. Seeing Quincy, they squeezed tightly together, mugging. "That's it," Quincy said. "Make love to the camera."
"You guys keeping up back there?"
Craig called to them as they all began to scale a slight incline. Downed leaves made the ground slick, and Janelle and Quincy held hands, alternately hauling each other up the hill. "Seriously, you don't want to fall behind," Janelle said with the authority of a tour guide. "These woods are haunted."
"Bullshit,"
Rodney replied. "It's true. An Indian tribe used to live here hundreds of years ago. Then the white man came and wiped them out. Their blood is on our hands, guys."
"I don't see anything,"
Rodney said, turning his hands in mock examination. "Be nice," Amy chided. "Anyhow," Janelle said. "They say the spirits of these Indians haunt the woods, ready to kill any white man they see. So watch your back, Rodney."
"Why me?"
"Because Craig is too strong to be defeated by a ghost, Indian or otherwise," Quincy said.
"What about you?"
"I said the white man killed them," Janelle said. "We're women. They've got no beef with us."
"People really did die out here."
Bette's is the one who said it. Quiet, observant Bette's. She looked at them all with her two large, slightly spooky eyes. "A guy in my worldly class told me about it," she said. "A pair of campers were killed in the woods last year. A boyfriend and girlfriend. The police found them stabbed to death in their tent." "Did they ever catch who did it?" Amy asked, sinking deeper against Rodney. Bette's shook her head. "Not that I know of." No one spoke as they climbed the rest of the hill. Even the crunch of their feet on the leaf-strewn ground seemed to quiet down, letting them subconsciously listen for the sound of someone else in the woods. In that soft, new silence, Quincy sensed they weren't alone. She knew she was being foolish, that it was simply the byproduct of what Bette's had told them. Yet she couldn't shake the feeling that someone else was in the woods with them, not very far at all, watching. A twig snapped nearby, fewer than 10 yards away. Hearing it made Quincy chirp out a half-shriek. It set off a chain reaction of yelps, rising almost simultaneously from Janelle, Bette's, and Amy. Rodney, on the other hand, laughed.
"God," he said. "Nervous much?"
He pointed to the source of the noise, a mere squirrel, its tail a white flag waving above the underbrush. The rest of them began to laugh, too, even Quincy, who instantly forgot how strangely jittery she had felt mere moments before. At the crest of the hill, they found a large, flat-topped rock as wide as a king bed. Dozens of names had been carved into the surface, remnants of similar kids who'd made the same trek. Rodney picked up a sharp stone and began to add his name to the list. Beer cans and cigarette butts were scattered around the rock's perimeter, and an unrolled condom drooped from the spindly branch of a nearby sapling, prompting disgusted squeals from Janelle and Quincy.
"Maybe you and Craig can do it up here," Janelle whispered. "At least protection is provided."
"If we do it," Quincy said, "it certainly won't be on a rock that, from the looks of it, is an STD waiting to happen."
"Wait, you haven't decided yet?"
"I've decided not to decide," Quincy said, when in fact she already had. Agreeing to sleep in the same bed with Craig sealed that particular deal.
"It'll happen when it happens."
"It better happen fast," Janelle said. "Craig is prime beef, Quinn. I'm sure lots of girls are dying for a taste."
"Interesting metaphor," Quincy replied dryly.
"All I'm saying is you don't want to wait so long that he loses interest."
Quincy looked to Craig, who had scrambled atop the rock and was studying the horizon. He was interested in more than just sex. Quincy was certain of that. They had been friends first, meeting on their official first day of college and spending all of freshman year engaged in a slow, budding flirtation. The dating part didn't happen until late August, when both returned to campus, realizing how much they had missed each other over the summer. And if Quincy had started to sense some impatience about sex on Craig's part, she chalked it up to desire and not the kind of pent-up frustration Janelle was implying. Now perched on the rock, Craig caught Quincy looking. She raised her camera and said, "Smile." He did more than smile. He stood with his fists on his hips and his chest puffed out like Superman's. Quincy laughed. The camera's shutter clicked.
"How's the view?"
she asked.
"Pretty swell."
Craig reached down and helped her climb onto the rock beside him. They were higher than Quincy expected, able to see how the rest of the forest sloped sharply downward for another mile before ending in a shadow-filled valley. The others joined them, with Janelle ordering another picture.
"Group shot," she said. "Everyone in. Even you, Quincy."
The six of them squeezed together, and Quincy stretched out her arm until everyone had edged into the frame. Once the picture was taken, Quincy studied its frenzied composition. That's when she noticed something behind them in the far distance. A mammoth building. It sat in the middle of the valley, its gray walls barely visible among the trees.
"What's that?" Quincy asked, pointing it out.
Janelle shrugged. "Beats me."
Betts, the wise owl, knew. "Of course.
It's an insane asylum," she said.
"Jesus," Amy replied.
"Are you purposely trying to freak us out? I'm just telling you, it's a hospital for crazy people."
Quincy stared at the asylum. A low-lying breeze in the valley rustled the trees around it, giving the place a shifting, restless air. Almost as if the building itself were alive. There was a definite sadness to the asylum. Quincy felt it emanating from the valley, all the way up to their lookout atop the rock. She imagined a storm cloud permanently hovering over the place, unseen but keenly felt. She was about to take a picture of it, but stopped herself. Something about keeping its image in her camera disturbed her. Standing next to Quincy, Craig studied the sky. The sun had slipped below the tree line and become a fiery glow that warmed the woods. Trees sliced the brightness, their long shadows grid-like across the forest floor.
"We need to head back," he said. "We don't want to be out here when it gets dark."
"And because, you know, Indian ghosts," Janelle added. Quincy joined in. "And crazy people."
Their departure was delayed by Rodney, who insisted on finishing his defacement of the rock. He added Amy's name beneath his own, connecting them with a plus sign, and surrounding it all with a hastily scratched heart. Then they were off, heading back the way they had come. It took them no time at all to reach the flat expanse that led to the cabin, the incline having made their journey feel longer than it actually was. All told, the distance between the flat rock and pine cottage was less than half of a mile. Still, the sun had fully set by the time they emerged from the woods, giving the cabin a pinkish autumnal glow. Shadows crept from the tree line and brushed its fieldstone foundation. Craig, still in front, stopped suddenly. When Quincy bumped into him, he shoved her backward. "What the—" "Shush," he hissed, squinting at the half-shadows gathering on the back deck. At last, Quincy saw what he had. The others did, too. Someone was on the deck. A stranger, with hands cupped to the window in the back door, peering inside.
"Hey!"
Craig called, stepping forward with his walking stick wielded like a weapon. The stranger at the door, a man Quincy now saw, spun around, startled. He looked to be about their age, maybe a couple of years older. It was hard to tell because of his glasses, which reflected the dying light, obscuring his eyes. He was thin, almost gangly, with his long arms pressed stiffly against the sides of his beige cable-knit sweater. A dime-sized hole sat at the shoulder, the white T-shirt beneath it peeking through. His pants were green corduroy, scuffed at the knees, and so loose around the waist that he had to crook an index finger through a belt loop to keep them from sagging.
"I'm sorry if I frightened you."
Hesitation streaked each word, as if he didn't quite know how to talk. He spoke English the way a foreigner did, halting and formal. Quincy listened for a trace of an accent, not finding one.
"I was looking to see if someone was here."
"That would be us," Craig said, taking another step forward,
his bravery impressing Quincy, which just might have been his plan.
"Hello,"
the stranger said, waving with the hand not hooked to his waist.
"Are you lost?"
Janelle said, more curious than afraid.
"Sort of. My car broke down a few miles away. I've been walking all afternoon. Then I finally saw the driveway to this place and hoped someone here would be able to help me."
Janelle broke away from the rest of them, emerging from the woods and crossing to the deck in three assured strides. The stranger flinched. For a moment, Quincy thought he was going to bolt, springing like a startled deer into the woods. But he stayed, keeping completely still as Janelle studied his shock of dark hair, his slightly crooked nose, the faintly sexy curve of his lips. "All afternoon, huh?" she said.
"Most of it."
"You must be tired."
"A little."
"You should come in and party with us." Janelle shook his free hand as the index finger of his other one twisted around his belt loop. "I'm Janelle. These are my friends. It's my birthday."
"Happy birthday."
"What's your name?"
"I'm Joe."
The stranger gave her a nod, followed by a cautious smile.
"Joe Hannon."
11. It's past 10 when I wake up. Jeff's side of the bed has long been empty. The sheets there cool under my palm. In the hallway, I pause by the guest room. Although the door is open, I know Sam is still around. Her knapsack remains in the corner, and the wild turkey still sits on the nightstand, only an inch of amber liquid remaining. Noise bursts from the kitchen. Drawers closing, pans banging. I find Sam there, a white apron tossed over a Sex Pistols t-shirt and a pair of black jeans. My head hurts, less the product of wild turkey than the surreal circumstances in which it was consumed. Although the events of last night are hazy, I have no trouble recalling Sam's repeated attempts to get me to say his name. I'm annoyed at both her and the memory. Sam knows this. I can tell from the apologetic way she smiles when she sees me. From the mug filled with coffee she all but shoves into my hands. From the blueberry-scented warmth that drifts from the oven.
You're baking?
Sam nods. Lemon blueberry muffins. I found the recipe on your blog. Should I be impressed? Probably not, Sam says. Although I was hoping you'd be. Secretly, I am. No one has baked anything for me since my father died. Not even Jeff. Yet here's Sam, eyeing the oven timer as it counts down to zero. I'm reluctantly touched. She removes the muffins from the oven, not giving them nearly enough time to cool before flipping the pan. Muffins drop onto the counter in a spray of crumbs and blueberry sludge.
How'd I do, Coach?
Sam asks, giving me a hopeful look. I take a judgmental nibble. They're slightly dry, which tells me she skimped on the butter. There's also a severe lack of sugar, which suppresses the fruit. Rather than either lemon or blueberry, the muffin is the flavor of paste. I take a sip of coffee. It's too strong. The bitter taste on my tongue bleeds into my words. We need to talk about last night. I was a bitch, Sam says. You're being all nice, and I don't talk about Pine Cottage, Sam. It's off limits, okay? I'm focused on the future. You should be too. Got it, Sam says, and I'd like to make it up to you somehow. If you let me stay longer, of course. She takes a deep breath, waiting for me to give her an answer. It might be an act. Part of me thinks she's certain I'll tell her she can stay. Just like she was certain I wouldn't let her trudge away with her knapsack last night. Only, I'm not certain about anything. It'll only be for another day or two, she says after I say nothing. I take another sip of coffee, more for the caffeine than the taste. Why are you really here? Isn't wanting to meet you enough? It should be, I say. But it's not your only reason. All these questions? All this prodding? Sam picks up a lumpy muffin, puts it down, checks her fingernails for crumbs.
You really want to know?
If you're going to continue to stay here, I need to know.
Right. Truth-telling time. No bullshit.
Sam takes a deep breath, sucking in air like a kid about to slip underwater. I came because I wanted to see if you're as angry as I am. Angry about what Lisa did? No, Sam says. Angry about being a final girl. I'm not. Angry or a final girl? Both, I say. Maybe you should be. I've moved past it. That's not what you told Jeff last night. So she had heard the two of us arguing in our bedroom. Maybe some of it. Probably all of it. Definitely enough to send her fleeing into the night. I know you're not past it, she says. Just like I'm not. And we'll never get past it unless we pull a Lisa Milner. We got stuck with a raw deal, babe. Life swallowed us whole and shit us out, and everyone else just wants us to get over it and act like it didn't happen. At least we survived. Sam lifts her wrist, flashing the tattoo there. Sure. And your life has been perfect ever since, right? I'm fine, I say, cringing because I sound just like my mother. She uses the word like a dagger, fending off all emotion. I'm fine, she told everyone at my father's funeral. Quincy and I are both fine. As if our lives hadn't been completely shattered in the span of a year. Obviously, Sam says. What's that supposed to mean? She digs into the front pocket of her jeans, pulling out an iPhone that she slaps on the counter in front of me. The motion startles its screen to life, revealing the unmistakable image of a man's penis. I'm going to go out on a limb here and assume that's not Jeff. Sam says, just like this isn't your phone. I look to the other side of the kitchen, the coffee and muffins suddenly sour in my stomach. The locked drawer, my drawer, is open. Dark scratches form a starburst pattern around the keyhole. You picked the lock? Sam lifts her chin in a pleased-with-herself nod. One of my few skills. I rush to the open drawer, making sure my secret stash is still there. I grab the silver compact and check my reflection in its mirror. I'm startled by how tired I look. I told you to leave it alone, I say, more embarrassed than angry. Relax. I'm not going to tell anyone, Sam says. Honestly, it's a relief knowing there's something dark underneath all that happy homemaker bullshit. Shame heats my cheeks. I turn away and lean against the counter, my palms flat against it, sliding through muffin crumbs. It's not what you think. I'm not judging you. You think I haven't stolen anything? You name it, I've probably taken it. Food, clothes, cigarettes. When you're as poor as I've been, you get over the guilt real fast. Sam dips a hand into the drawer, pulling out a stolen tube of lipstick. She gives it a twist and, mouth forming a perfect circle, swipes the cherry red tip over her lips. What do you think? Is this a good color on me? That has nothing to do with what happened at Pine Cottage, I say. Right, Sam replies, lip smacking. You're completely normal. Fuck you. She smiles, a cherry-lipped grin that flashes like neon. Now that's what I'm talking about. Show some emotion, Quinn. That's why I wanted you to say his name. That's why I broke into your secret goody drawer. I want to see you get angry. You've earned that rage. Don't try to hide it behind your website with your cakes and muffins and breads. You're messed up. So am I. It's okay to admit it. We're damaged goods, babe. I peer into the drawer again, looking at each item as if for the first time, and realize Sam is right. Only a seriously damaged woman would steal spoons and iPhones and silver-plated compacts. Humiliation grips my body, squeezing ever so slightly. I push past Sam and move woodenly to the cupboard where my Xanax is stored. I shake a pill into my palm. Do you have enough to share with the whole class? I stare at her dumbly, my mind elsewhere, neurons focused solely on getting that light blue pill into my body. The Xanax, Sam says. Give me one. She plucks the pill from my hand. Instead of swallowing it, she crunches it between her teeth like a Flintstones vitamin. I take mine the usual way, chased down with grape soda. Interesting method, Sam says, as she runs her tongue along her teeth, catching stray granules. I take another gulp of soda. A spoonful of sugar. The song doesn't lie. Whatever gets the job done, I guess. Sam holds out her hand. Give me another. I tap a second pill into her palm. It stays there, cradled like a tiny robin's egg, as she gives me a curious look. You're not having seconds? It's not a question. It's a dare. All of a sudden, I feel like we're replaying yesterday afternoon. Back in the kitchen, Sam watching, me inexplicably wanting to impress her. Sure, I say. I take another Xanax, followed by more grape soda. Instead of chewing hers, Sam gestures for the soda bottle. She takes two hearty swallows, finishing up with a quick belch. You're right. That does make it go down easier. Again, she holds out her hand.
Third time's the charm.
This time, we take the pills simultaneously, passing the soda quickly between us. All that Xanax has left a bitter spot on my tongue, which is made even more obvious by the sticky fuzz of grape soda spreading over my teeth. I laugh at the ridiculousness of the situation. We're just two massacre survivors downing Xanax. Lisa would not have approved.
Are we cool? Sam says.
Soft morning light slants from the kitchen window onto her face. Although she's made sure to put on makeup, the sunlight exposes tiny webs of wrinkles starting to form around her eyes and the corners of her mouth. They draw my gaze the same way I'm drawn to a Van Gogh, always looking for the glimpses of canvas hidden between the dollops of paint. That's the real Sam I'm looking for, the woman behind the tough girl mask. The glimpse I get now is darkly alluring. I see someone who's still trying to comprehend what's become of her life. I see someone who's lonely and sad and uncertain about everything. I see myself, and the recognition makes my body hum with relief that there's someone out there just like me. Yes, I say. We're cool. The Xanax kicks in 15 minutes later while I'm in the shower. My body softens in increments, feeling as if the shower's steam is seeping into my pores, swirling inside of me, filling me up. I get dressed as if on a cloud, floating in lightweight, drifting down the hall, where Sam waits by the door, also floating, her eyes smiling. Let's go. Her voice is muffled, soft. A long-distance call. Where? I ask, sounding like someone else. Someone happier and carefree. Someone who's never heard the name Pine Cottage. Let's go, Sam says again. So I go, grabbing my purse before following her into the hallway, the elevator, the lobby, the street, where sunlight shimmers down on us, golden and warm and radiant. Sam is radiant, too, with sun-orange highlights in her hair and face glowing pink. I try to pause at each door we pass, checking my reflection in the glass to see if I'm radiant, too, but Sam pulls me away, into a cab that I never noticed her hail. We float on. Into the steaming thickness of the city, then into Central Park, where a fall breeze trickles in through the cab window, cracked an inch or two. I close my eyes, feeling the air's caress, until the cab stops, and Sam is tugging at me again, me barely feeling it. We're here, she says. Here is Fifth Avenue. Here is the concrete fortress of Saks. Here is us floating across the sidewalk, through the doors, into the gleaming pattern of perfume counters, passing scents so strong I can almost see them stretching in hues of pink and lavender. I trail Sam through the rainbowed air and up an escalator. Or maybe we're not going up at all. Maybe it's just me, floating into the women's department, where another rainbow appears, made real in rows of cotton, silk, and satin. Other women mill about. Bored salesgirls and haughty matrons and listless teenagers who should be in school but instead are here, sighing into their cell phones. They give us judging looks, if they bother to look at us at all. Jealousy. They know we're special. Hi, I say to one of them, giggling. Love that skirt, Sam says to another. She leads me to a rack of blouses, white ones spattered with blooms of color. Grabbing one off the rack, she holds it up and says, What do you think? That would look amazing on you, I say. Really? Yes, you have to try it on. Sam grabs a blouse. Give me your purse, she says. My purse? I forgot I had brought it with me. Then a line of clarity cuts through the haze. its appearance so sudden that I grow dizzy. "You're not going to steal it," I say. Sam's expression is blank. The golden glow on her skin fades to gray. "It's not stealing if you've earned it. And after what we went through, babe, I'd say we earned this big time. Purse, please." With arms so numb I can barely feel them, I pass the purse to Sam. She tucks it under her arm and disappears into a dressing room. While she's gone, a glint of gold catches my eye and lures me across the sales floor. It's a small display of accessories. Thin belts and chunky bracelets and loops of beaded necklaces. But what holds my attention is a pair of earrings. The two dangling ovals remind me of twin mirrors, drawing the light until they glow. Radiant. Like me. Like Sam. I finger one of them, the light glinting. My reflection leaps off its surface, face oblong and pale. "You want them, right?" It's Sam, out of the dressing room and suddenly behind me, whispering in my ear. "Go on. You know what to do." She pushes the purse back into my arms. Without even looking, I know the blouse is in there. It radiates a heat that makes the whole purse pulse. I unzip it just a crack. Inside is a slip of white silk, a splash of color. "It's not hurting anyone," Sam says. "You're the one who got hurt, Quinn. You and me and Lisa." She drifts to a nearby rack of sweaters. She grabs two handfuls and drops them onto the floor, plastic hangers clattering. The noise draws a sales girl who zips to Sam's side. "I'm so clumsy," Sam says. That's my cue. As Sam and the sales girl collect the down sweaters, I snatch the earrings from their display and drop them into my purse. Then I speed walk from the scene of my crime. I'm halfway out of the women's department when Sam catches up to me. She grabs my wrist, yanking me to a slow walk while whispering, "Easy, babe. No need to look suspicious." But we are suspicious. And I'm certain all those bored sales girls and haughty matrons and listless teenagers who should be in school know what we've done. I expect them to stare as we pass, but none of them do. We're so radiant, we've become invisible. Only one man notices us. A 20-something in distressed jeans, Brooks Brothers polo, and shiny black sneakers with red stripes down the sides. He spies us over one of the fragrance counters, pausing mid-spritz to watch us float to the door. I watch him, too, noticing something click just behind his eyes. It worries me. "We've been spotted," I tell Sam. "Security." My heart starts doing jumping jacks in my chest, thumping faster and faster. I'm scared and excited and breathless and exhausted. I want to run, but Sam keeps gripping my arm, even as the man drops his cologne, picks up a newspaper sitting on the counter, and starts to follow. He calls out to us, "Excuse me." Sam curses under her breath. My heart beats even faster. "Excuse me," the man says again, putting a more urgent spin on it, getting the attention of others who look up, look at him, look at us. We're visible again. Sam increases her pace, making me do the same. We reach the door and start to push through it, but the man is behind us, moving fast, reaching out to tap me on the shoulder. Out on the street, Sam prepares to run. Her body tenses next to mine, readying for the sprint. I tense up too, mostly because the man is right at my back now. His hand drops onto my shoulder, making me spin around and hold the purse out to him, as if in offering. The man looks not at the purse, but at the two of us, a stupid grin on his face. "I knew it was you." "We don't know you, man," Sam says. "I know you," he says. "Quincy Carpenter and Samantha Boyd, right? The final girls." The man fishes in the pocket of his jeans, pulling out a pen tangled in a ring of keys. He yanks it loose and hands it to me.
It'd be awesome if I could get your autographs.
He then offers the newspaper. It's a tabloid, the cover stretched tight and facing us. When I look at it, I see my own face staring back at me.
See?
The man says, proud of himself. I teeter backward, dropping to earth, the sidewalk under my feet suddenly hard and jarring. A second look at the newspaper confirms what I already know. Somehow, Sam and I have become front page news. 12. Our picture takes up most of the front page, filling it all the way to the masthead. The image shows Sam and me during our first meeting, standing outside my building, sizing each other up. It captures me at my very worst, with my weight shifted to my right leg, hip jutting, arms crossed in suspicion. Sam's positioned slightly away from the camera, with just a slice of her pale profile visible. Her knapsack is still settling at my feet, and her mouth yawns open as she speaks. I recall that moment with cutting exactitude. It was right before Sam started to say, "You don't need to be such a bitch." The headline sits below the photo in large red letters, "Soul Survivors." Beneath it is a photo of Lisa Milner, similar to the one on her book cover. Next to it is a headline smaller in size but no less alarming, "Final Girls Meet After Suicide of Kill Spree Victim Lisa Milner." I look to the masthead again. It's the same tabloid that reporter idling outside my building yesterday said he worked for. His name lurches into my head. Jonah Thompson. That devious prick. He must have still been there, spying on us while scrunched in the front seat of a parked car, camera poised on the dashboard. I snatch the newspaper from the autograph hound and start to walk away. "Hey," he says. I keep walking, tripping down Fifth Avenue. Even though my legs are wobbly from Xanax, my muscles yearn for another. And then another. As many as it takes to plunge me into oblivion for a few days, which still wouldn't be enough to snuff out my anger. I flip through the newspaper as I walk. Inside it is a bigger photograph of Lisa and a series of shots detailing the first conversation between Sam and me, all taken from the same angle. I look gradually less angry in those pictures, my stance and expression softening. As for the actual article, I can barely make it through the first two paragraphs. "What does it say?" Sam asks as she hurries to keep up. "That we're both in the city, united by Lisa's sudden suicide." "Well, it's kind of the truth. And it's no one's goddamn business but ours, which is exactly what I'm going to say to Jonah Thompson." I toss through the newspaper until I find the address of its newsroom. West 47th Street. 2 blocks south and 1 block west. I surge forward, fueled only by rage. I go 2 steps before realizing that Sam hasn't moved. She stands on the corner, nibbling at her cuticles while watching my retreat. "Let's go," I say. Sam shakes her head. "Why not?" "Because it's not a good idea."
Says the woman who just encouraged me to shoplift.
This turns the heads of several people passing by. I don't care. I'm still going.
"Whatever cranks your chain, babe."
"You're really not pissed off about this?"
"Sure I'm pissed."
"Then we should do something about it."
"It won't make any difference," Sam says. "We'll still be on the front page."
More heads turn. I scowl at those who meet my gaze. Then I scowl at Sam, frustrated by her lack of anger. I want the Sam from an hour ago, urging me to embrace my rage, but she's been replaced by someone made mellow by the same Xanax that itches within me.
"I'm still going," I say.
"Don't," Sam says. I start walking again, anger pushing me forward. I call to Sam over my shoulder, my words stretching into a taunt. I'm going!
Quinn, wait!
But it's too late for that. I've reached the other end of the block and am crossing the street against the light. I think I hear Sam still calling after me, her voice blending into the din of the city. I keep going, newspaper in my fist, refusing to stop until I'm face to face with Jonah Thompson. There's no getting past the security desk. It sits just inside the lobby, mere feet from the busy bank of elevators. I could make a run for the constantly opening and closing doors, but the guard on duty is a full foot taller than I. He'd be able to cross that lobby in a flash, blocking my path. So I march right up to him, rolled newspaper in hand, and announce, "I'm here to see Jonah Thompson."
"Name?"
"Quincy Carpenter."
"Is he expecting you?"
"No," I say, "but I know he'll want to see me." The guard checks a directory, makes a call, and tells me to wait by the mural positioned opposite the elevators. It's a massive Art Deco thing, a Manhattan skyline painted in muted tones. I'm still looking at it when a voice sounds at my back.
"Quincy," Jonah Thompson says. "You change your mind about talking?"
I whirl around, the sight of him boiling my blood. He's wearing a checked shirt and skinny tie, trendy and smug. A bulging file folder is tucked under one arm. Probably dirt on his next victim. "I'm here to get an apology, you son of a bitch."
"You've seen the paper."
"And now the whole goddamn city can see where I live," I say, waving said paper in his face. He blinks behind his thick-framed glasses, more amused than alarmed.
"Neither the article nor the photo captions mention where you live. I made sure of that. I didn't even name the street."
"No, but you showed us. You identified who we are. Now the whole world can Google our names and see what Samantha Boyd and I look like, which means any psycho can show up and stalk us."
This he hasn't thought of.
The slight whitening of his face makes that abundantly clear.
"I didn't mean to."
"Of course you didn't. You were just thinking about how many papers you'd sell, what kind of raise you'd get, how much the inevitable offer from TMZ would be."
"That's not the reason."
"I could sue you," I say, interrupting again. "Sam and I both could. So you better pray that nothing happens to us." Jonah gives a hard swallow.
"So you came here to tell me you're going to sue the paper?"
"I'm here to warn you that there'll be hell to pay if I ever see another article about me or Samantha Boyd. What happened to us was years ago. Let it rest."
"There's something you need to know about that article," Jonah says.
"You can shove that article up your ass." I move to leave, but he grabs my arm, tugging me backward. "Don't touch me!" Jonah's stronger than he looks, his grip alarmingly tight. I try to get free, arm twisting, elbow aching.
"Just listen to me," he says. "It's about Samantha Boyd. She's lying to you."
"Let me go!" I give him a shove, harder than I intend. Hard enough to get the attention of the guard, who barks,
"Miss, you need to leave."
As if I don't know that. As if I'm not aware that the longer I stay in Jonah's presence, the angrier I get. So angry that when Jonah moves toward me again, I give him another shove, this time intentionally harder than the first. He rocks backward and the folder drops from his arm. It flaps open on the way down, spitting out its contents. Dozens of newspaper clippings fan out across the floor, their headlines shouting variations of the same story. Pine Cottage, Massacre, Survivor, Killer. Low-quality photos accompany most of the articles. To someone else, they'd mean nothing. Copies of copies, all pixels and smudges and Rorschach blots. Only I can see them for what they really are. exterior shots of Pine Cottage, taken both before and after the murders. Yearbook photos of Janelle, Craig, the others, a picture of